Welcome to Statewide Reports and Conversations from in and around Illinois and the Midwest. I'm Sean Crawford. This hour, the promise of high-speed rail. The Chicago to St. Louis corridor, which cuts through central Illinois, has seen faster trains going above 100 miles per hour. But what about true high-speed rail, traveling twice as fast? We'll discuss what it would take to achieve that goal and expand service to other communities. Granite City near St. Louis is home to a steel mill, but despite a lot of national action in the industry, the facility's days may be numbered, and that worries the town and employees. We'll have a report. Personal finance can be daunting, so maybe a financial advisor is needed. We'll hear some tips on how to choose one. And at DePaul University, contraceptives are banned. The Catholic school's rule has not stopped some students from obtaining birth control from an underground service. Coming up this hour on Statewide. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. This past school year, for the first time, Illinois schools were required to teach a unit on the experience and history of Native people in the state. Peter Medlin brings us the story of how teachers brought those stories into the classroom.
At the DeKalb County History Center, Michelle Donahoe reads from an 1843 map of Chabanas Township.
But this is reserved for the use of Chief Chabanas and his band based on the Treaty of Prayer de Chien in 1829. So, like, right there, this is a tremendous primary source document.
Donahoe is the History Center's executive director, and that 180-year-old map shows the DeKalb County land stolen from Chief Chabanas, which was returned to the Prairie Band Potawatomi just last year. And when the news coincided with the launch of the state's new Native American curriculum requirements, Donahoe knew they had an opportunity to help teachers bring local history into their classroom. So last summer, they hosted a multi-day training with teachers from every district in the county to show them how to teach with primary sources like the 1843 map. And she says they also have old biographies about Chabanas and court records where the chief sues settlers for stealing his timber.
This is not something that is really distant. Like, this happened here in our county.
Emily Weller is an elementary instructional coach in DeKalb, and she says the training helped fill a gap in her own education. She doesn't remember learning much at all about Native American experiences, let alone this local history. And Weller also wanted to make sure their classes didn't get stuck in the history, especially with the Prairie Band formally returning to the region.
We want them to know that Native Americans are still here. Mm-hmm. And so bringing that balance with the past to the current.
One of their goals was to keep it as local as possible. The center shared articles and artifacts teachers wove into instruction. A second grade unit focused on DeKalb history, while a fourth grade unit centered around Native American cultures, myths, and legends. And they're not the only ones thinking locally. The Newberry Library in Chicago worked with a team including many Native researchers and advisors to assemble an interactive Indigenous Chicago curriculum. It features digital maps, activity modules, oral histories, and much more. Like in DeKalb, students explore those old maps, like a French colonial portrait of Midwest Indigenous tribes from 1718, with a voiceover guide from the Newberry's Rose Myron.
A map oriented around Native villages shows us that as late as the 19th century, settlers were still living in a world that was primarily shaped by the location and actions of Native communities.
Steve Schwartz is a history teacher at Oak Park and River Forest High School, and he was part of a year-long pilot of that program and continues using the resources in his History of Chicago class. And he says the tools show students how Native communities, trails, and treaties created the geography of Chicago. And when they ask why there weren't any reservations in Illinois until last year, he can show them the removal routes.
And you show them these maps. Well, this is the road out to Iowa. This is the road out to Wisconsin. This is how they end up across the Mississippi.
He brings Indigenous voices into his courses with the oral histories and audio files of Native people pronouncing tribe names and phrases in their language.
Kilunamyamyake.
That's how you say "We are Miami" in the Miami, Illinois language spoken by many tribes that called Illinois home. Schwartz also doesn't want to get lost in the past. He highlights Chicago's place in Indigenous activism movements in the 1960s and 70s, as well as the city's Native community now with over 65,000 Indigenous people from around 175 tribes. And other groups across Illinois are also assembling education resources. The Illinois State Museum created activities and videos for students with the museum's Tribal Relations Director, Logan Pappenfort, who's a member of the Peoria Tribe of Oklahoma, which has roots in Illinois.
What I find incredibly fascinating about this story is that this is a piece of pottery from 2,000 years ago, telling the same story that my people have told for that full duration of time and potentially longer.
And the Illinois State Museum is also in the process of returning to the tribes the remains of thousands of Native people. Steve Schwartz says his students had always asked why they didn't teach Indigenous history. So now he says it's rewarding to give them the tools to have real conversations about Indigenous issues.
The challenge is to, as teachers, really create this mosaic of what American history really is. And you have to fight against the dominant narrative a lot to do that.
And now that Native American instruction is here to stay, he hopes there'll be even more resources that spotlight important stories traditionally left out of history classes. I'm Peter Medlin.
A lot of people have financial questions these days, and for many, they simply want to know how to pick a personal financial advisor. So we asked an expert.
Hello, I'm Sherry Greco-Rikus, co-founder of Rappaport-Rikus Capital Management. We manage $1.2 billion in client assets. And also, I am the author of the book, Maximize Your Return on Life, Invest Your Time and Money in Your Values. Probably this is something that you can't pinpoint, but I think the most important thing is the rapport you have with the advisor. So I always advise trying to meet face-to-face. I know a lot of times people are doing things on Zoom, but you can really get a feel for the person face-to-face. You need to feel comfortable with that person. You want to be comfortable to ask questions. You can't be intimidated and fear that they won't answer your questions. You need to understand. But finally, you need to go with your gut. Then I often tell people, what are you looking for? Are you looking for an advisor that just does investments? Are you looking for someone that just does financial planning and you'll do your own investments? Are you looking for someone that does both? So once you define what you're looking for, it makes the search a little easier. Another great question when you meet with an advisor is you want to know what their approach is to financial planning. You might want to see some examples. Do they have sophisticated tools to do your plans? Can they help you with insurance? Will they coordinate with your estate planning attorney and your taxes? Will they look at your big picture? Will they look at Social Security, college planning? Make sure that they have the skills and the wherewithal to help you with those planning things that you will need. So once you kind of understand their approach to financial planning, a really good question is, how do they get paid? And it should be very transparent. There's several fees that you need to look at. One is the management fee. So that's an overall fee that they may charge. Another is underlying investment fees. So you want to understand the fees within these investment vehicles. Are there trading fees? And is financial planning an extra fee? And so you can, you know, kind of look at apples to apples when you compare fees. My two last advice that I will give you as we part is I always say interview a few advisors because you'll get a really good indication what you like or don't like and what's most important to you. And at the end of the day, ask for references. You know, obviously they're going to give you happy clients, but you want to just talk to some of the references before you make a final decision. So this is a big decision. I'm a big advocate of hiring a financial advisor. They often will take a lot of the emotion out of the investing and the financial planning, but a good financial advisor will be open, but you'll be able to exceed your financial goals.
That's Sherry Greco-Rikus, co-founder of Skokie's Rappaport-Rikus Capital Management. The firm manages $1.2 billion in client assets, and Rikus is the author of Maximize Your Return on Life. Well, this week we're looking at an important service for the state, Amtrak. Getting people where they need to be faster has been long in coming. Charlie Schlinker unpacks the generational project that brought faster train service to Illinois.
It took more than 30 years to bring 110-mile-an-hour passenger rail to the Chicago to St. Louis corridor. That's a long haul of feasibility studies, planning, scrapping for money, and bargaining with public and private entities even before construction began. Chris Koos sits on the National Board of Amtrak and is the longtime mayor of Normal. Even with that tenure, the passenger rail project predates him. Who says every big project must have three things.
I would say vision, planning, and tenacity.
Early studies spoke to the potential of a 110-mile-an-hour network out of Chicago. The study said there was a market for higher speed rail. They said it would improve air quality. There would be an economic benefit to the state and the communities connected by the service. Joe Szabo headed the Federal Railroad Administration during the Obama administration. Before that, he was a union guy. Szabo says that analysis was important to bring other people to embrace the unified vision of rail service that would cut a big chunk of time off a car trip.
It started with those of us, myself included, in the union arena, you know, meeting weekly with those in the environmental community and thinking about how do we build this out. And it was from there that we started sitting down with the president of the Illinois Chamber of Commerce, with the Chicago Chamber of Commerce.
Szabo had also been a South Suburban mayor in Chicagoland. He went to mayors along the corridor and to the Illinois Municipal League, touting economic benefits for their communities. After that, Szabo added university presidents to the coalition. They saw their Chicago area students use the train to get to campus. Some doubted the economic analysis. Mayor Chris Koo says speed alone is not enough.
You know, 110 service doesn't exist on its own. You also have to have frequency of that service, and you also have to have on-time performance of that service. So if one of those three is missing, the other two don't stand on their own.
There were two prerequisites for success in getting 110-mile-an-hour passenger rail. Former Federal Railroad Administrator Joe Szabo says without both of them, it wouldn't have happened. The first was doubling the number of state-supported Amtrak trains on the corridor. The economic claim had been the more frequent the trains were, the more people would use them, because they have options if a business meeting time changes or runs over. You don't want to get stuck away from home at the end of the business day. When the hearings to expand state-supported rail came, Szabo says all that work assembling a broad coalition that bought into the vision made passage less hard.
It's almost like once we pushed that boulder uphill, it started rolling downhill, you know, with its own momentum.
The idea of frequency of trains was orthodox and long-known transit theory, but supporters needed to dispel doubts about the economic benefit case.
And watching the ridership explode exponentially. I mean, within like 3 months, ridership more than doubled on all the state service. And it just continued to build month after month after month.
After that, even though there were more trains per day along the corridor, they still couldn't go faster than 79 miles an hour. The second element that made the project achievable came a year or so after the increase in the number of daily trains. It was the election of Barack Obama as president and the passage of the American Recovery and Reinvestment Plan to stimulate the economy following the national financial crisis. Obama wanted to make passenger rail a part of that investment. Former Transportation Secretary Ray LaHood of Illinois says it was the first time any White House had put down an $8 billion marker on high-speed rail. LaHood says Illinois got a significant chunk of that money.
More important than anything, it requires collaboration. Big projects get done when smart people put their minds together, agree on the plan, and then begin to implement it.
LaHood says the administration of then-Governor Pat Quinn had already demonstrated it had skin in the game by boosting the number of trains. And so, for the first time in eons, Joe Szabo said federal funding was made available to help state DOTs implement railroad projects. He says, sure, it was luck, but the state was ready. The analysis had been done decades earlier. Then the proof of concept came with growth in ridership and the state partnership commitment to more trains. Szabo says, though, you never know when the window of opportunity is going to open. And if you are not prepared, you are unable to pass through. And there was still a lot of work to do. Faster train speeds mean you need a better rail bed, you need to close the number of grade crossings, you need fences to stop pedestrians and wildlife from getting on the tracks, you even need better crossing gates so motorists can't make fatally poor choices to drive around the gate. Ray LaHood says any major infrastructure upgrade takes years of work and many phases.
What you find with these projects, a few people wake up every day and the only thing they think about is how do we get this project over the finish line and how do we keep it going.
Even after all that, it took years more to start running faster trains from Chicago to St. Louis. The corridor shares traffic between passenger and freight trains. Amtrak operates one, Union Pacific, Canadian National, and other companies operate the other kind. And if trains are going that fast, there's a lot less time to make a decision to stop if a slow freighter is ahead. When the vision began decades earlier, Chris Koos of Normal says the planners knew there had to be a way to let engineers know exactly where a train ahead of them is, but it didn't yet exist.
That primarily had to do with a GPS system called positive train control, which is a safety issue for trains traveling at that speed with the amount of traffic on the tracks.
Europe decided to go with a single system for both passenger and freight trains. The U.S. said every rail company could choose its own system if they could talk to each other. Former Federal Railroad Administration head Joe Szabo says developing and then testing the technology for interoperability delayed the timeline a couple more years.
Never anywhere on this planet had implementation to this scale, to this magnitude, been attempted. It's important you get it right.
Another thing, former Transportation Secretary Ray LaHood says, big honking infrastructure projects are always very costly, billions in the case of faster rail service. You have to embrace uncertainty.
And it's very difficult to really calculate what it's really going to cost until you begin the project, begin the work, and try and stay on a schedule.
When you get to the finish line, it might not be the same place you thought you were going all those years ago when you started. In the case of 110-mile-an-hour passenger rail, Chris Koos says the vision is, as yet, incomplete.
When the 110 plan was identified, there would have been two more trains a day in and out of Bloomington Normal. And that kind of disappeared in the rounder years, and I think there's still holes in the schedule that would certainly increase the usage of that system.
It's also true that when society does a hard thing, it can be a continual process that does not, in fact, have an end. Joe Szabo says you may have to keep renewing and rebuilding once it's in place.
Charlie Schlinker with that report. With 110-mile-per-hour trains now in place, the talk has started on a 220-mile-per-hour corridor. But what would it take to make that happen? We'll have that part of the story in just a moment. This is Statewide. We're back on Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. It took more than 30 years to bring 110-mile-per-hour passenger train service from Chicago to St. Louis. It could take that or longer to get true high-speed rail along the same corridor. Charlie Schlinker examines the way forward.
This is progress. New means of serving people better at lower cost per ton mile.
Imagine passengers going from Chicago to East St. Louis in about 2.5 hours, or Chicago to Bloomington Normal, Bloomington Normal to East St. Louis, or say Chicago to Champaign-Urbana, each in an hour and change. Those are huge savings in driving time, never envisioned by the makers of this 1951 film, Boosting Freight Railroads.
Railroads mean many things to the people of Illinois, and to thousands of our people today, they mean jobs.
The Illinois High-Speed Rail Commission, supported by the Illinois Department of Transportation, is studying the possibility of high-speed rail along the Chicago to St. Louis corridor. There are several possible alignments. One skips Bloomington Normal and goes to Champaign-Urbana, Decatur, and then Springfield. Another goes from Chicago to Peoria and then to Springfield. All the possibilities would use dedicated track, no stops outside major cities, and complete separation of grade crossings and crossovers. Chris Koos, the mayor of Normal, sits on the board of Amtrak.
The multiple billions of dollars that it would take to do a high-speed rail line, regardless of the alignment, is pretty daunting and, you know, a 15 to 20 year project.
18 other countries do high-speed rail quite well. Former U.S. Transportation Secretary Ray LaHood says, for instance, China, Japan, and Italy all have 200-mile-an-hour trunk lines fed by lower-speed rail routes, and all have direct, robust support of national governments, not just state governments.
Without that kind of vision, and without that kind of financial commitment, We are way, way behind in America.
During the Obama administration, the nation took its first $8 billion step toward high-speed rail. $4-plus billion went to California, which LaHood says has doubled that investment in the succeeding 20 years. Dallas to Houston is getting ready to go, LaHood says, and the Trump administration could find plenty of private dollars if it wanted to commit to it. Amtrak board member Chris Kuss says the current administration pulled the plug on that study. In Nevada, the Biden administration plunked down $3 billion on the Las Vegas to L.A. route.
So the initiative that was started by President Obama with his vision for passenger rail is moving along, not as quickly as we'd all would like, but it's happening in America.
And even though the San Francisco to L.A. effort under construction is way over budget and taking too long, LaHood says it will also be a win. Okay. Back to Chicago to East St. Louis. The study will take a while. Mayor Chris Kuss has doubts.
I see it to be visionary, but I don't see the economics of it working.
He says the amount of land acquisition would be incredibly high for a green grass route.
It'll be interesting to see what a private organization, Brightline, is trying to do in California, where they're trying to leverage existing land along an interstate. And if that works, that may be a solution. Then it really narrowly defines a corridor.
Part of the Illinois study does consider using highway right-of-way and even county road right-of-way in some spots. Consultant Charles Quandel says it will also be important to use electric propulsion, like the Japanese Shinkansen bullet train, instead of the engines Amtrak currently uses. The rate of acceleration, Quandel says, is faster with electric.
Current Amtrak equipment that's diesel-powered, it takes about 4 miles at its top speed. In contrast with the catenary electric propulsion, they're able to hit that same speed in just about a mile.
The current Chicago to St. Louis corridor through Bloomington Normal already helps passengers who would rather not drive that distance. Joe Szabo, a former head of the Federal Railroad Administration, says the competition is different for 220-mile-an-hour service.
In 220, what you're looking to do is to be superior to air.
Szabo believes in a passenger rail program in which you connect 220 service from major markets with minimal stops to a 110-mile-an-hour regional network and feeder lines into that network that travel at a traditional 79 miles an hour. And understanding how the aviation market connects, he says, is important. Szabo says 220-mile-an-hour service can be used to shift passenger demand to rail.
When you're talking about a distance of 500-600 miles, that's kind of the sweet spot for 220-mile-an-hour service. And it frees up that capacity in the aviation network for the longer-distance flights, which are much more efficient, you know, in the longer distance.
It's possible the airline industry might not see it that way. The ongoing Illinois High-Speed Rail Commission study is trying to gauge whether people want 220 service by doing a variety of surveys online and in person. Rhett Fussell is a transportation engineer with a consulting firm, WSP. Fussell spoke at the commission meeting in May.
O'Hare and Midway, those both agencies refused, the airport lawyers refused to allow us to do surveys on the airport property, and so did St. Louis.
The commission does have more than 6,000 responses to surveys. Illinois Department of Transportation Transit Planning Manager Hannah Martin says comments are mostly positive so far.
We've got a lot of support coming in for the route to include the Champaign-Urbana area. We've also had some support. A few folks have mentioned Decatur and Peoria. There are comments saying, you know, make sure that this is efficient when you talk about a feeder network. Train to train is better than train to bus.
There are other ways to get at the question of market demand, studying population, strength of local economies, how those economies complement each other in business and industry, and how they connect to each other via air. That all factors into the choice of where to put 220 service. Amtrak board member Chris Kuss says let's wait and see because the economic studies have not yet been done. Both Kuss and former Federal Railroad Administration head Joe Szabo suspect that on the surface, Chicago to Minneapolis might be a better fit for the first true high-speed rail line in the Midwest. Szabo says Minneapolis is a stronger population center than St. Louis, and it may be a better fit with Chicago. Szabo says it will be important to make sure nobody tries to put their thumb on the scale in generating those studies.
That's kind of the million-dollar question, isn't it? Because you really do want to try to make certain that you have, you know, an honest assessment that is being based on population and economies.
The cities of Champaign-Urbana, Decatur, and Peoria are all very interested in having a stop on the potential 220 service route. One government official says, get your popcorn and settle in to watch the politics happen. Joe Szabo says the answer to political infighting is to make sure everyone knows they won't be left behind.
Everybody wants the big prize, but perhaps they're not the best example for the big prize, right? But that doesn't mean that they should be left alone and left isolated. It comes back to this interconnected network to make sure that the citizens of all these communities have quality connectivity to the broader system.
Szabo says in order to really show that ridership is going to be there for 220 service between Chicago and East St. Louis, it's going to be important to continue to grow ridership on the existing 110-mile-an-hour service.
Charlie Schlinker with that report. Former Transportation Secretary Ray LaHood says wherever high-speed rail happens, it will have to be a public-private partnership because of the expense. A couple in Colorado was interested in buying an old church building. They wanted a place they could call home and a place where they could also create art. They found what they were looking for in Western Illinois. Rich Egger has the story.
Ryan Taylor and Nicole Carer spent more than 5 years talking about buying an old church building. They spent 3 years actively looking. Taylor says he's read that two churches close in the U.S. every day. That adds up over the course of a year.
So that's 700 pieces of property, potentially like this, that are going unloved, and people don't see that they can be something beyond just a church.
He says they searched all over the country for a building they could give their love to for the rest of their lives.
We were in Denver, and as you probably know, the cost of living in Denver is really high. So we just had our feelers out, and we're lucky to live in an age where the internet gives us access to every property available anywhere in this country.
Taylor says sometimes a building caught their attention, and they would fly or road trip to check it out. Then they came across one in Macomb.
I actually rode the Amtrak out here from Denver 14 hours before I saw this place in person. And we put an offer in before my wife had even seen it. After all the searching, this was the one.
The building had been St. George's Episcopal Church. It's just off the courthouse square. Outside the building, he points out the original sanctuary space was built in 1895.
This style of building is called Carpenter Gothic. I'd never quite heard that term before, but once I researched it, this is a very similar style to other places in this part of the country, similar architecture, and the colors are also very important as far as that particular style goes.
Taylor says his background is in construction and architecture. He'll do some repairs to the building, but will maintain the reds and creams used on the exterior. It's a large space that also includes an office and a commercial kitchen. They closed on it about 15 months ago. Taylor says the former church section of the building will eventually be a gallery with limited hours.
This space here is what brought us to Macomb.
We're now in the sanctuary.
This beautiful, beautiful church, the woodwork. We've got 30 pieces of original stained glass, not original to the date, but original to the building. And we look forward to being caretakers of this space for as long as this church is standing. And it's been here 130 years. I think we've got some time.
This is also now his shop, where he works as a toy maker and toy painter. He specializes in Sofubi.
And that's essentially the Japanese translation for soft vinyl.
These are hollow soft vinyl collectible toys, often inspired by Japanese pop culture. Taylor says the toys are popular overseas, especially in Tokyo and Hong Kong, and his toys are all original.
They don't really have a backstory. The thing I specifically like about the stuff I do is that I can sculpt a toy, and it can have the feel and the quality of a toy that maybe has been around for 40 years. It looks like it may have a backstory, but it's really something that just came out of my own heart and soul.
Taylor's creations are currently sold under the name Ophelia Toys, but they plan to transition to a new name, Red Dragon Gallery. It's inspired by a red dragon depicted in one of those beautiful stained glass windows.
I think it's about the most beautiful piece of glass I've really ever seen in my life.
Taylor wants Red Dragon Gallery to be an inclusive space. He says they hope to meet other artists who want to show their work and collaborate on projects. And he'll continue hand-making toys. He says it's cool knowing that something made in Macomb is living in people's collections in places such as Tokyo. Rich Egger reporting.
China is the third largest export market for U.S. ag products, buying American staples like soybeans and beef. But the country is also a destination for many specialty products that have fewer options for sales at home and abroad. Negotiations between the U.S. and China over a new trade agreement have meant months of uncertainty, as Harvest Public Media's Hope Kerwin reports that has left some specialty producers worrying about the future.
The ginseng roots in Will Su's hands sound almost musical as they clink against each other, falling back into a large cardboard box that's waiting for shipment.
So this is what ginseng would look like, kind of coming in a dried form off the farm.
Su operates one of the largest ginseng farms in Wisconsin, where almost all of the crop is grown in the U.S. The slightly bitter, herbal-tasting root is a staple of Chinese medicine, and about half of Su's crop is exported to Asian processors, most of whom are in China and Hong Kong. But those sales have been on hold since President Donald Trump came into office and started a back-and-forth exchange of escalating tariffs with China.
We still are holding about 80% plus of our 2024 crop because of tariffs.
That's thousands of cardboard boxes sitting in Su's warehouse. Some of his buyers are waiting to finish sales in the hope that China will lower a 32% tariff on U.S. ginseng that goes back to the first Trump administration. Earlier this month, the president announced the U.S. had reached a new trade agreement with China, but details have yet to be released. Meanwhile, a 90-day pause on higher import taxes between the two countries is set to expire in early August. Farmers across the ag industry are waiting to see how the deal will impact their products. But Su is skeptical the agreement will greatly improve his market. He's worried that demand will continue to erode for Wisconsin ginseng, a premium product akin to buying wine from Napa Valley.
And it's very hard then to convince them to go back to something that is more expensive once they've swapped to a cheaper substitute.
China is also an important market for products that have little domestic demand. That includes pork offal, or what are sometimes called variety meats, the internal organs of a hog like the heart and liver. Because of cultural differences, exporting these byproducts provides a much higher price than if they were sold in the U.S. And around 55% of U.S. offal exports go to China, according to the National Pork Producers Council. Ag economist David Anderson from Texas A&M University says prices for offal fell abruptly in response to the tariff exchange in April, but that price has rebounded since the start of the 90-day tariff pause last month.
I think it highlights that there is international demand and that the tariffs do matter.
But some industries are worried about a more lasting impact from the continued trade tensions with China. Tony Clayton operates a livestock export company in Jefferson City, Missouri. He sells cattle, hogs, and other animals all over the world for breeding. Clayton says exports of breeding swine to China were strong at the start of the year. But after the roller coaster of tariffs and pauses, he says America's brand as a reliable seller has been tarnished, not only in China, but in markets around the world.
The damage is deep on this one. And there's not a week that goes by that I don't have 3 to 4 customers ask the question, what's happened to the United States?
Clayton says China tightly controls the sale of livestock into their country, making it a difficult market to break into. The on and off tariffs exchanged with the U.S. has opened the door for competitors like Australia and the European Union. And he says that shift is likely permanent.
I just wish we had a consistent trade policy. We start, we stop, we start, we stop. And it is just difficult to make any plans.
Clayton is working to squeeze in one sale of breeding pigs before the tariff pause ends. But he's already looking for new markets to start developing in case sales to China don't recover. I'm Hope Kerwin, Harvest Public Media.
Some college students going underground to provide birth control. That story coming up on Statewide. You're listening to Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Most colleges have plenty of free condoms available at their health centers or even Plan B vending machines. DePaul University in Chicago is at the opposite end of the spectrum. The Catholic campus has a total ban on distributing birth control. A student group tried to fill that gap with free contraceptive delivery, but DePaul officials suspended the organization. It's forced what is known as the womb service further underground. Lisa Curry and Phillip reports.
Maya Roman lives with her little sister and parents in an apartment in Albany Park. It's on the second floor of one of the few remaining Victorian houses on their block. It's filled with family photos and kid art, and Maya's anxious dog and her grandmother's two birds.
She has difficulty walking, okay. So we're just taking care of her birds right now. But they're lovers, so they make a lot of noise.
We've got a little time before we have to head to DePaul. So over banana nut muffins, Maya tells me how she got so fired up over reproductive justice and came to start what she and her friends call the womb service. The story stretches back to middle school.
The sexual education at CVS was just really bad.
She says it used scare tactics about sexually transmitted diseases to encourage abstinence instead of teaching students about their bodies and safe sex.
And I'm really fortunate because my mom's a nurse. So in middle school, while I was getting the public education that was respectfully abysmal, my mom would have like this little book and she would be like, you know, like go through this, ask me questions. Like it's okay to ask questions about what's happening with your body.
But Maya worried about her friends who weren't getting the knowledge and openness they needed from school or their families. And she found out Planned Parenthood offers free materials on sexual health and wellness.
So I would take that and I would like go to my friend groups and be like, this is like what you need.
Once Maya enrolled at DePaul, she was shocked to find students who needed even more. For 20 years, officials there have outlawed the distribution of any kind of birth control on campus. They say contraceptives go against the school's Catholic identity. Maya and the other students running the womb service call the policy out of touch and worse. Dangerous. As Maya says, college is prime time for sexual exploration, and an unplanned pregnancy can derail a student, especially if they're poor.
It affects the economic status of that family moving forward because you're less likely to be able to complete your degree. So it impacts not just the next, you know, 9 months, it impacts your entire livelihood forever.
Maya's gotten so fired up that she's lost track of time. She starts scrambling around her dining table, grabbing a bunch of brown paper bags and stashing them into a black tote. Each baggie contains some combination of condoms, dental dams, Plan B, pregnancy tests. Through the womb service, any student at DePaul can request these supplies free of charge. They're donated to the group by Planned Parenthood and another nonprofit. Maya's got a whole pile of them in her room, and she's due on campus soon to hand some off to a volunteer. So after she's grabbed the tote and two other bags with her laptop and school stuff, we hustle to the Francisco stop on the Brown Line.
We'll probably duck underneath to hop on.
Rockwell is next.
We find seats at the back. Maya's phone is lighting up because she doesn't just run the womb service. She's got classes and studying and two jobs to help pay for school.
It is so crazy that for something like contraceptives, that's on us to have to take care of.
Because regardless of DePaul's policy, the need is there. Maya says the womb service gets as many as 25 orders a week. She says there are students who can't afford birth control or whose families are against its use.
Not every student has an environment where that is a welcomed ideology or a welcomed practice. And which is concerning because it's healthcare, but that's the truth of it.
Maya, with her many bags, leads me to a campus building where she sets up her home base. She gets her laptop out while we wait to go meet one of the womb service volunteers.
I will just step out onto public property, which is the sidewalk or the street. As long as the distribution happens on public property, it doesn't violate DePaul's guidelines.
Out on the sidewalk, she pulls a paper bag from her tote and hands it over to a student with bright red hair. This volunteer will take the package and deliver it to the student who requested it at one of five drop locations just off DePaul's Lincoln Park or downtown campus.
Hey, here you go. Thank you so much. Yeah.
It's like a bizarre drug deal, one that's become even riskier since DePaul revoked the group's status as a registered student organization last month. Back on the train, Maya explains it's because of their affiliation with Planned Parenthood. The National Reproductive Justice Group has become a lightning rod for the movement against reproductive freedom. And right now, the Trump administration is pressuring campus leaders to get in line with their conservative agenda.
College campuses are supposed to be a safe place for you to explore who you are as an adult. And with those rollbacks and with the way colleges and universities are essentially cowering, individuals are left scrambling to fill in those blanks and fill in those gaps.
A DePaul spokesperson said the university supports student-led dialogue on reproductive health, but it does not permit student organizations affiliated with groups that go against its Catholic mission.
That's Lisa Curry and Phillip with that report. An Illinois university has released a policy profile on creating what are known as age-friendly communities. Brady Johnson brings us more.
Senior Research Associate Mim Evans at the Center for Governmental Studies at Northern Illinois University says creating communities to help all residents is imperative to adapt to our changing world.
Well, the first thing that made me want to study it is that we are undeniably an aging country, an aging world. By 2030, there'll be more people over the age of 65 in our country than there will be people under the age of 18. So this isn't something that's off in the future that might happen. This is something that has already happened and will just continue to become a more significant part of our communities.
Evans says looking for improvements for older residents in the community will benefit all residents. According to Evans, municipalities do not need specific plans to address aging residents. They need to incorporate that knowledge into all other sectors so that it becomes second nature for local governments when crafting city action plans.
I think that for a long time, and I certainly fell victim to this as well, we kind of thought about, at this point, I'd have to say the last third maybe of people's lives as being kind of a static time period or time period of a slow decline, and that mostly you needed to make sure that people had the physical care that they needed. Well, that's not really what we mean by age-friendly, and that's not the situation with the oldest residents in our communities.
Evans expands, saying older residents want to be involved in their community. That means offering more community events, bolstering public transit, and allowing events and services to be held within neighborhoods. A significant aspect of their policy profile is housing, something most Americans are struggling to find and retain. Evans says older Americans are staying in their current, often larger homes because nothing is available to meet their needs. Not so much retirement and nursing homes, but smaller properties built for older residents in mind, closer to community services, which would benefit all residents.
By providing better options that appeal to people who no longer are in the family raising stage of life, those people will be more likely to put those homes on the market, increasing the supply for younger families who are looking for housing. And hopefully that makes them more affordable by there being more that are available.
Another aspect that older Americans noted in their focus groups is healthcare. She notes a silver lining in the ongoing pandemic is that telemedicine is expanding, allowing more Americans to seek care without having to leave their homes.
So as we look for ways to make healthcare more accessible for older people, we will actually be making it more accessible for everybody.
The research team noted that 25% of the total American workforce is over the age of 55, which is causing institutional knowledge loss and workforce shortages.
We don't have the luxury of the large workforce that we had generations ago, and that making continuing to work more appealing and easier
for older workers will be of great value to everybody, to the older workers who will be able to stay engaged and also continue to bring in additional income beyond their retirement savings and Social Security, and also to the businesses that are going to be in need of their expertise and our communities who are going to be in need of their labor.
The team, supported by a transformational grant from the McHenry County Foundation, worked with the city of Woodstock, Illinois, to create an age-friendly action plan. The grant allowed them to create a task force of numerous community members to speak on housing, healthcare, social clubs, and park maintenance. Evans says the broad-based plan informs the city to consider its aging population in every decision to ensure projects support everyone.
It can be addressed by preparing one of these broad-based plans, which I think is great for allowing the community to then coordinate its response and to bring everybody to the table. The other approach, and this is something we're also doing at CGS with the many communities that we prepare other kinds of plans for, is that every other plan that is made, for example, a comprehensive land use plan or a downtown revitalization plan or a park district plan, whatever it might be, that each of these has a component that overtly addresses the needs of an aging population.
Evans says it's a good challenge for communities to face, and everyone hopes to be a part of the older resident group at some point. So it's in everybody's interest to be age-friendly in community development.
That's Brady Johnson reporting. The deal to acquire U.S. Steel was finalized a few weeks back. The new Japanese owner will invest $11 billion across the U.S., but it doesn't appear Granite City Works will see any of that. Some suspect the Metro East Mill could be closed within a couple of years. Locals say they feel forgotten by both companies and one of their biggest advocates, President Donald Trump. Will Bauer explains.
In 2018, Trump visited Granite City. There, he said his tariffs on steel and aluminum delivered a great victory for the steelworkers.
After years of shutdowns and cutbacks, today the blast furnace here in Granite City is blazing bright. Workers are back on the job, and we are once again pouring new American steel into the spine of our country.
Fast forward 7 years, those same blast furnaces now sit idled. Instead of nearly 2,000 workers, about 900 currently work at the mill. There, they process steel shipped in from other locations. And the new owner, which the Japanese pronounce Nippon, doesn't appear to have plans to keep Granite City around long term.
They've left Granite City out of the conversation, and it's still left out of the conversation.
That's Doug May. He's now retired, but he worked at the mill for 43 years. In addition to the visit in 2018, Trump campaigned this past year to bring back American manufacturing. Now that the U.S. Steel Nippon deal has closed with Trump's approval, the question remains. Have Trump and the companies kept their promises to those in the Metro East, or have they forgotten them? Well, it depends on who you ask. May believes Trump and U.S. Steel haven't lived up to their promises.
So believe what you want, but nothing in this so-called partnership is for certain except a bunch of greedy people got their money and their ownership. Granite City steelworkers got slapped in the face, left out in the cold, and completely forgotten for all the historical work they have done to save domestic steel.
And May isn't the only one. Granite City Mayor Mike Parkinson also says he's frustrated.
If you were serious about it in 2018, why aren't you here now?
Parkinson recently wrote Trump a letter. He wrote that not only did Trump help restart the blast furnaces in 2018, he also won over voters. So far, Parkinson said he's only heard empty talk to get the deal done.
I am not hearing I'm bringing these people back to work. That's what we heard when the president came years ago, right? Is we're firing this plant back up and we're going to keep these American jobs American and keep them right here in Granite City and keep this steel going. I'm not hearing that.
Others say U.S. Steel is to blame. That includes steelworker Michael Poole, who spoke outside the mill in Granite City.
I think that U.S. Steel has told Trump this is what they're looking for, and Trump is backing what they want.
There are a few things that Poole and everyone else can seem to agree on. The steel mill should be worthy of investment, and they're hoping Trump can use his influence to make that happen.
If he was able to do that, I think that he wouldn't be sorry. I feel like it would be definitely a win for not just Granite City and the Granite City Works. It would be for the whole country. It's just a great thing to keep as many facilities steel working facilities open as we can.
Others have reached out to Trump, too. State Senator Erica Harris represents the area. She and fellow Republican Amy Ellick wrote him a letter. Harris was at Trump's rally 7 years ago. She says Trump told the crowd he was there to help places like Granite City.
I am taking him at his word for that, and just as the representative here, want to remind him of Granite City and how things did turn around for the short term after that visit, and that we would love for him to be mindful as he's making those decisions now at the federal level that will impact us here locally.
The White House didn't respond to requests for comment. Now, the steelworkers, local officials, and the community will continue to do what they've been doing the last couple of years. Wait for more answers. In Granite City, I'm Will Bauer.
We're out of time for Statewide. Thanks for being along with us. And remember to join us next week for more reports and conversations from in and around Illinois and the Midwest. You can find us where you get your podcasts, through the NPR app, and at nprillinois.org. I'm Sean Crawford. Statewide is a production of NPR Illinois, with help from other Illinois public radio stations.